Right now, I want to get to our first broadcast partner, who's located in Washington, D.C. Now, last weekend, we did everything we possibly could to get him online, but we couldn't make it happen. But Ken Timmerman is the man we're talking about, who covers geopolitical activities for us. And actually, Ken, where were you last week as you and I were trying to put this all together?
Well, I was in northern Iraq, Jimmy. I was there primarily for the 25th anniversary of the gassing of the Iraqi Kurds by Saddam Hussein. This took place at Halabja. I went there for the memorial services, interviewed some of the survivors, people who did manage to get out, heard just horrible stories. One young man we spoke to, well, he wasn't young now, but he was young at the time. He was a teenager. Was trying to flee with nine of his family members, and he was the only one who actually made it out alive. This was a horrendous war crime, and Saddam Hussein has been found guilty of genocide against the Kurds. By the way, during that whole period, it's called the Anfal in 1987-1988, when he was gassing the Kurds, he also destroyed 106 Assyrian Christian villages in northern Iraq, and he went after them because they had essentially sympathized with the Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and risen up with them in rebellion against Saddam Hussein.
Now, wait a minute. Did you say that Saddam Hussein was responsible for gassing these Kurds? Is that the phrase you used?
Yes, poison gas. He used chemical weapons, and, you know, he had used them all throughout the war, the eight-year war with Iran from 1980 to 1990. Well, he started using them in 83, all the way up to the end in 1988. But he used them against his own citizens, his own Kurdish citizens, in Halabja and in other towns and villages in northern Iraq.
I would think that those were considered chemical weapons of mass destruction, right?
Absolutely correct. He used nerve gas and mustard gas.
See, I was playing on that for a purpose. I want the people to know that there were chemical weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and one of the reasons U.S. military went in there. It was, I guess, this last week, the 10th anniversary of that invasion. Can you give us any heartbeat of how the people are doing? Are they able to rebuild this war-torn nation, or are they still in pretty deep trouble?
Well, President Obama has disengaged from Iraq. There are no longer any U.S. troops in Iraq. We are not providing any security assistance to speak of to the government. And this week there were rather significant car bombs and terrorist attacks throughout much of Baghdad and parts in the south. You have a government led by al-Maliki, which has become a form of dictatorship, and people feel it in Iraq. He has brought the country on the verge of civil war, not just between Sunnis and Shias, but between Baghdad and Erbil, the Kurdish regional government. Now, the president of the Kurdish government, Masoud Barzani, is doing what he can to avert any kind of armed conflict. He does not want to see a civil war erupt. But at the same time, he wants to make sure that Baghdad lives up to its commitments to, first of all, allow the Kurds to exploit the oil that's in their territory, and then after that, to settle the problems left over in Kirkuk, which was a Kurdish city, until 1987, when Saddam forcibly deported the Kurds to southern Iraq and resettled Arabs in their place to try to change the demographics. So there are complicated things going on in Iraq. We are not a player. We have left a security vacuum, and the Iranian regime has pretty much jumped in to fill that vacuum, and is controlling al-Maliki almost as a puppet.
Well, as we've been listening to Ken, it's evident that this is an ongoing story. The world is watching all of this happening. But the Bible talks about it, Revelation 18, there will be a major operation in the area of Iraq, i.e. biblical Babylon, in the future. And we'll continue to cover the story of the rebuilding of Iraq until we're out of here, or something else takes place. Give me a quick, brief thought or two about President Obama's visit to Israel and then to the Palestinian Authority as well, but not necessarily about what happened there, how it reflects upon the Obama administration and, i.e., other geopolitical activities.
Well, Obama gave this much-touted speech to Israeli university students, where essentially he called on them to rise up in a political struggle against their own government, against the government of Benjamin Netanyahu and his coalition. It was pretty extraordinary for a president of the United States to do something like that in a foreign country. I think if an Israeli prime minister or a French president or a German chancellor came to the United States and spoke at George Washington University or someplace else and said, "You American students, you hold the future in your hands, you need to rise up against your government," I think we would have been pretty upset. Now, this said, Benjamin Netanyahu seemed to take that in stride. It was the least bad thing that could have happened from his point of view. When Obama met with the Palestinians, he pointedly did not denounce Israel's so-called settlement activity, you know, the building of bedroom communities on the outskirts of Jerusalem so people can commute back and forth to work. And he could have done a lot of things that would have been much worse. So Obama seems to have tempered somewhat his very harsh criticism of Israel and of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. They seemed much more on the same page when it came to Iran and how to deal with Iran's nuclear weapons program.
Let me talk to you about the Syrian situation, the use of chemical weapons of mass destruction. There's a mixed report coming out. Was it the rebels, the opposition, who used it against the Syrian people, or was it Bashar Assad releasing this on the opposition? Israeli sources are saying chemical weapons were used. American sources saying we don't have proof of that. What's going on?
To tell you the truth, I find this very confusing, and I'm a bit perplexed that we don't have better information and more clear information. The Israelis have said that they treated four Syrians who showed up at the border between Syria and Israel for chemical weapons symptoms. They did not say who they were. They didn't announce whether they were Syrian soldiers or Syrian opposition fighters. So we don't really know who used the weapons, but there does appear to have been some release of chemical weapons. It's extremely serious. Israel's new intelligence and national security minister, Yuval Steinitz, has said that Israel will have to respond to this as quickly as possible. And you have here in this country Senator Lindsey Graham saying that the United States should quickly take some sort of military action to secure the chemical weapons stockpiles in Syria. Now, these are vast stockpiles, Jimmy. They're enormous quantities of weapons in the thousands of tons of agent, for example. And to secure all of those stockpiles will take a very major military operation. I'm not sure the United States is prepared to do that. I'm not sure that Israel is prepared to do that. But seeing these weapons on the battlefield was a shock this week.
Yes, it certainly was. Ironically, while President Obama was in Israel, there was a news release coming out of Iran. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, said that Iran will annihilate Tel Aviv and Haifa if they are attacked by Israel.
Well, he makes statements like that frequently. The word annihilate may be a new addition to his vocabulary instead of saying he will wipe Israel off the map. But what he's clearly trying to suggest here is not an Iranian first strike, but an Iranian retaliatory strike should Israel attack Iran. And it suggests that Iran would consider, the Islamic Republic would consider using weapons of mass destruction against Israel, because they certainly wouldn't annihilate Tel Aviv or Haifa with a rocket attack or with a attack of Scud missiles or longer-range missiles with conventional warheads. So is he saying that we have actually developed nuclear weapons, that we have in Iran developed a warhead that is deliverable by a missile? That would be an extremely troubling development. It would be a radical departure from what the U.S. intelligence community and the Israelis have thought of the Iranian nuclear weapons program to date. It would show that they're much further advanced than certainly the American intelligence agencies are willing to admit.
Give me about 15 seconds on this. The Turks are watching as the Kurds in Turkey say they want a ceasefire. The PKK, which is the organization of the Kurds up there, I know you're in Kurdish area. What about this?
Well, this is a big deal, and Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, has been in prison since 1999, and yet he communicates with the outside world. He also has been negotiating with Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey. So for him to call on his fighters to engage in a ceasefire, to stop firing and to retire into northern Iraq is really a big deal. That civil war has been going on since 1984, so if a ceasefire actually takes hold and the Turks offer some concessions to the Kurds, recognizing their language, for example, it's a major step forward.
Wow, wow. Ken Timmerman, covering geopolitical activities for us. Last week, he was in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area, so he has great input on these issues that we discuss. Ken, thank you so very much. Glad you got back safe, and we'll talk again next week.
Thank you so much, Jimmy. God bless.